So this is a workshop being sponsored by the American Association of Blind Teachers, and the focus of this workshop is teaching in colleges and universities and the issues that our vision impairments may bring to that. The workshop is being held on Sunday, February the 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I think we'll begin with introductions, and then the format will be, after the introductions, Suzanne Ament, my co-host, will speak for a while first about her experience. I'll speak for a bit, then we'll open things up for questions and dialogue and comment. I'm Susan Glass. I am a retired community college and university teacher, full-time and tenured, and I live in Saratoga, California.
I'm Suzanne Ament, and I am an associate professor of Russian history at Radford University. I've done that job for about 16 years, and I've had some other jobs as well, short term, prior to that. I got my PhD in Russian history at Indiana University, and I am now currently in Southwest Virginia.
Hi, Angela, do you want to go next?
Hi, my name is Angela Hebert. I'm in Long Beach, New York, and I've been a tenured professor since about 2004 at a local community college called Hudson County Community College. Prior to that, I was an adjunct instructor for, 10 plus years, and I teach pre-college English composition, lit classes, and that's about it.
Hi there. I'm Tabitha Brecky, and I am in Auburn, Alabama, and I work at Auburn University in the Office of Accessibility as an accommodation specialist, but I also teach an adjunct course, a graduate course for the adult education program.
And Don?
Okay, I'm Don Hahn. I'm a vocational rehabilitation counselor with the New York State Commission for the Blind. I also hold a master's degree in education with an emphasis in English grade 7 to 12, and I'm a long-term member of AABT.
Beautiful. Alan?
I'm Alan Tripienko. I'm in Indiana, actually just north of Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, yeah.
And I've taught physics for a while, and the classroom, I've lost my vision just recently, and the classroom management problems are, I just can't deal with the high school kids, so I'm not credentialed to teach. I've got a bachelor's degree, but I'm thinking about going back and getting my PhD, but I definitely want to teach physics somewhere, so I had some success at it.
Wonderful.
And I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm.
Have we all introduced ourselves?
Yes.
I believe we have. So we'll begin, Suzanne Ament, with you, if you'd like to start us.
Sure. I am tasked with trying to sort of set up a discussion or a talk about things that concern a four-year teaching stint, so that what you'd think of as the tenure track university kind of job. And the first thing, and I guess I was sort of thinking we're going to have people that may or may not know anything, so if it's a little bit basic, forgive me, and if not, so be it. To get a job in a field at a university, you pretty much have to have the graduate terminal degree for a tenure track job these days, especially in certain fields. But so what that means is that you've been planning this for a long time, and even voc rehab often recognizes that you're not going to get jobs unless you have graduate degrees in these different fields. And that did happen to me as an aside, that I was challenged. The voc rehab challenged me that I shouldn't be getting funding. And then the judicial court said, oh, yes, she should. So because if that's her goal, then she has to have a terminal degree, the highest degree possible. Mm. So saying that, that means you've been planning quite a bit, and you don't just go out and sort of put out feelers for jobs with sort of a cold approach. You look in the Chronicle of Higher Education, you hear about jobs through your fields, journals, and that kind of thing, and you apply generally on a national level for these kinds of jobs. And you may go to conferences and what they do, the cattle call, where you have appointments and you put in for what you're interested in, and you get a 15-20 minute interview at a table or in a hotel room or, you know, that sort of thing. So it's a very specific job hiring process that can be rather intimidating, but at the same time, it also is pretty clear-cut at how to get a job. And sometimes that feels limiting, but it's the way it usually works. You can't just sort of show up at your neighborhood college and say, hey, I want to teach physics. And the reason for this is that departments get budgets and they get awarded positions by the administration of universities. Therefore, if they don't have the money to hire you, they can't even look at you. There's just no point. You're wasting your time and theirs. So that's a really different thing than what we think about employment in general. So that was something that struck me in trying to think of what was unique about the four-year experience or the four-year university experience. The other thing then that automatically comes up for blind people in employment is whether you're going to disclose that you're blind in your application process or not. And certainly you are not required to. There's no requirement by law or any other thing that you have to disclose it. But my feeling is that by the time you're getting to your job search and you're in graduate school and you've maybe gone to conferences and you know the people in your field, that the likelihood that most people may have heard of you or know that there's somebody who's blind is probable. And so what I've sort of chosen to do is try to set off my blindness as an asset in my application, that I can teach students proactivity, that I can add a different spin on things, that it'll be a new experience for students, especially if I'm going to be dealing with core or freshmen or something like that, that would be an asset to be a unique person in the university setting. And some people that flies with and some it doesn't. But that's a question everybody has to decide, and there are good and bad experiences, and Susan and I sort of hashed out a few of these when we were preparing for this, and you know, one was going into an interview and having somebody say, well, if you're blind, how can you teach? You know, sort of like, what do you mean, how can I teach? I know the material, I talk to the students, I answer questions, I give them questions, you know, it's like, what do you mean, how can I teach? But that also leads to the idea that both Susan and I think would back for no matter what job, is that it's our responsibility to sort of catch those questions and predict those questions, because by law now they can't ask you that question. They can't say, oh, my gosh, you're blind. How are you going to do this? They can only ask a series of questions they ask to every candidate. And so we have to be the ones to put them at ease and say, I use this method, or I use a note taker, or I have a course assistant, or I use PowerPoints, or I whatever you do, that you set them at ease, that you know what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. Now, the question of how to do things and et cetera, we can probably be pretty field-specific, but at the same time, I think what I thought about was that the thing that works best is kind of a combination of collaboration and creativity. Just the idea that when you do want to do something and you're not sure how to do it, or you want to bring about a sort of a solution, sometimes creativity and collaboration can really work. And I'll give you an example. When I was still in graduate school, I just was finishing, there was a one-semester, one-course position to replace somebody who was on leave at a university in Indiana that was about 2 hours from where I lived. And I, of course, don't drive, and I didn't have any family members or anyone with me. And the university where I went sort of heard about this issue And so, well, we have a room that is often lent to guests or sort of connected with a dorm that you could stay in, and we'll provide you with a student reader, and I can have office hours on campus and that kind of thing. So I only had to find transportation to the university on a Monday and home from the university on Wednesday. And it worked marvelously because I could fit in with the students and learn, you know, get to know them as opposed to a quick commute for teaching two classes. And that was all nothing. That was prior to ADA, by the way. No, I don't think it was actually, but it was later. But they didn't have to do any of that, you know. But by being honest and forthright and positive about what might help me, there were other people that could put in solutions, and that was a neat thing. So I think it's good to let people know in a positive way if there's something you do need. And generally, when you get hired at a four-year university, and this was something I wasn't totally aware of when I got my job at Radford, was that that's the time that you should really put in your request for materials, whatever that be, because that's the time that professors do their research labs. That's when they do their requests for certain leave or whatever they need to do. So when you're going up for that, even if it is something to do with ADA accommodation, it is the time to ask for the max, because that's what when you're going to get the max you're going to get. Because once budgets get set and you're normal and you're not a new hire, it's a lot harder to get extra things. So that's one piece of advice I have for somebody going into a four-year job, into a tenure-track job. So, and again, all these jobs might be different. You might do more teaching. You might do more research, depending on your field, depending on the school. And so that's sort of a general topic about four-year universities that we can get into more if anybody wants to. My load, teaching load, happens to be fairly high. It's a 4-4 teaching load, meaning I teach four courses every semester. And for a research university, that's a pretty high teaching load. So my university is more of an emphasis on teaching. And we also have a lot of students that don't have a lot of skills. So that's a little bit different than what I expected I was going to get into. And it has caused some issue because they're kids that aren't really able or willing to ask for help. So it has become necessary, and I think Alan mentioned the issue of classroom management, that some of these kids are acting more like high school kids, and they won't put their phones away, they won't take notes. So one of the things that my department actually changed over time was to give me enough hours of an assistant to have somebody in class with me to be a proctor, but also to help me understand what the kids needed, sort of what was going on behind the scenes that I wasn't noticing, and stopping some cheating and some other things that were going on. So unfortunately that had to happen because I prefer to be in class by myself, but I think this is helping them and the students in the long run, and that's the point, you know, is that you want them to progress. So I guess I think I will stop there, and maybe just before I stop, I'll just give you a brief rundown of where I went to school and the differences. I got into Russian studies and I became a professor mainly by following the next step. I didn't have this goal, I'm going to be a Russian history professor. I took Russian, I loved it. I took more Russian, went to Russia, Soviet Union, came back and decided, well, now I'm going to go to grad school. So I did Russian studies, and then that sort of petered out because that was too general of a field. I ended up going into history instead of getting a job because there were no jobs at the time, kind of thing. And then all of a sudden I got the chance to teach. And I would say that if you want to go into college teaching as a grad student, get an opportunity to teach because you'll have a lot of support and you'll get to see if you like it, if it's something for you. And that's important because if you go all the way to the PhD and then decide you don't like it, you know, that's sort of your most likely job goal is to teach with a PhD, that would be a bit of a disappointment, I would think. So I kind of came at it with, oh, okay, I can teach. I kind of like this. And then I realized, yes, and I'm paid to learn in my field. So that's another plus, is that you keep getting paid just to study instead of paying to study. So anyway, I'll stop with that and hope it wasn't too rambly, and turn it over to Susan for her experience at the with the community college especially.
Great. I don't think that was rambly at all. In fact, you've made what I want to do easy, because there's a lot of pieces I can pick up on. Just momentarily, I will fill in a little bit of my own introduction. I realize after hearing the rest of you, I was a bit sketchy. I went to the University of California, Santa Cruz for my bachelor's degree, and the University of Massachusetts Amherst for my MFA in English with comparative lit and poetry emphases. And I graduated from UMass in 1983, got my first job at San Jose State University as an adjunct faculty member in 1983. Taught at San Jose State part-time for 14 years and did what all part-time faculty often do, which is your beltway commuting. You're teaching at two or three schools to make your salary stretch. And then after several, well, I think it was three or four tries at a tenure-track position, I was hired in 1997 at a local college called West Valley Community College. We have 104 community colleges in the state of California, and this is mine. I'm south of San Francisco by about 50 miles. And I was at West Valley College for 16 years, teaching full-time, working in tenure capacity, and participating in shared governance and the various leadership activities that are naturally a part of collegial campus life. So that's a little bit of background on me. So you can tell by what I said that I'm a little older. I'm now 61. And when I and I'm also an English teacher, by the way. I taught composition, creative writing, technical writing, and then we had a pretty neat lit program, so I got to do some women's studies, American lit, and some very interesting interdisciplinary work, too, most of which happened in the tenure job at West Valley Community College. But what I'd like to do now is pick up on a couple of themes that you raised, Suzanne, and just place my perspective in tandem with yours. And the first one concerns whether you apply cold or not to a position. And certainly for a full-time tenure-track position, I echo Suzanne's sentiment that that's not what you do, that they're usually nationwide or locally. You go to conferences. If you're applying in a community college for bread-and-butter courses such as English or math, there are going to be a lot more application opportunities, but not as, you know, and whereas if you're applying for a subject where there's less faculty in a field like, you know, history or physics, they may not come up as often, but they do come up, and you go through the process that everyone else does. As an adjunct, and often what happens, by the way, in the field of English is that if you apply for a full-time position at an institution and you don't get it right away, they'll often invite you, based on your interviews, to come and be a part-time faculty member there or adjunct, which is a very good way to get a foot in the door. So that's another thing to do. My initial experience was that I came back to California, my home state, after being in Massachusetts, and did something that I don't know if I would do now, but I did it as an adjunct. I put on my nicest clothes and took my dossier, and my mom, who's living in the area, gave me a lift over to San Jose State University, and I walked into the English department and said, "May I please speak to the chair?" and just introduce myself, and I guess I got lucky, because he said, "Well, as a matter of fact, we're interviewing for part-time hires now. Let's fill your application out." So I got my first job by doing it cold, but it wasn't really cold. I had rehearsed what I was going to say. I had my dossier with me. My curriculum vitae. I was ready for the conversation. And, you know, often the way in English departments that you get in the door is you do a lot of adjunct work first. It's a follow-up on what Suzanne said about how in graduate school it's a good idea to teach, because then you discover if you like it. In my case, I got to teach both in the writing center and in the classroom at University of Massachusetts. And when I came back to California, I figured, well, one of the best things to do is start out, you know, one course at a time and build up from there. So I didn't have to worry about disclosure that day because by virtue of walking into Dr. Galm's office with my cane and my materials, I had done just that. This was 1983, and I came on board with no accommodations from the university way before ADA. Didn't know I could. I came in armed with a Perkins Brailer, a typewriter, what I'd learned in graduate school from teaching about syllabus making, and I hired my own reader. Now, once I was there for a while and made friends, collaboration began to happen. Things started happening. They started figuring out what I needed. And because I was new and because I was adjunct, I did not do what Suzanne said, which is ask for what my accommodations were, in part because I was so green at age 26 that I didn't know what they were, if that makes any sense.
Oh, I didn't either.
It was different when I got my full-time job at West Valley in 1997, because, of course, that was post-ADA. I did what Suzanne did when I was filling out my written applications. I actually disclosed by working my blindness into the essays they had given us. They would say things like, you know, how would you go about teaching a unit on multiculturalism in an English 1B class? Describe your curriculum design, describe the assignment you would make. And so I just kind of worked it in there because I kind of wanted to put it on the table, ahead of time. That's what I did 1 year. I did get called for a final interview. Another year, I don't think I said anything in the initial essay. And then when I was called for the interview, I said, yes, I'm delighted to come. By the way, I am totally blind. I will be bringing my guide dog. And since you have an on-the-spot grading of an essay and conference assignment, may I please bring a reader for the first 15 minutes? And that was probably a good way to do it. You know, the fear I think we have about disclosure is that if we say something right away, someone will not give us the interview. And so I think sometimes, you use your best judgment. You're really being hired on whether you know composition, whether you know adult learning theory, whether you know Russian history and literature. Those are the skills they're really working for. And as Suzanne says, it's incumbent on us when we get there to demonstrate how we will actually do the work that we're going to do. And so when I went to the community colleges for my interviews, I brought my, believe it or not, at the beginning it was a DOS computer with JAWS on it. That changed, but I brought my technology into the room and demonstrated right there how I would use it. I had prepared handouts for the group and collated and braille labeled the folders ahead of time so that when I was handing them out to the interviewing committee, I could show them the material. And before I got started, I said, let me make sure I did this right. In your packet, you have these handouts in the following order. Am I correct? And they said yes. And that was kind of how we worked out the interview process. Once I was hired at the community college, it was a lot easier to request technology. At the time, I had a Braille light when I came in, and they were going to give me an office computer, and I said, can we outfit this with JAWS? And they said, certainly, and just went ahead and did it. Things had changed a lot by then. One thing that Suzanne and I didn't talk about a lot, you mentioned it briefly, Suzanne, when you were talking about the room where you were able to stay at the university. Mm-hmm. But a big factor when we're teaching as visually impaired people is going to be transportation. Are we going to be taking buses? Are we going to be riding with colleagues? Are we going to be able to put that in place, in time? And how is that going to work? And sometimes where we teach can depend a lot on proximity. Maybe smaller universities are more comfortable for us, maybe larger ones. It's a decision that we make individually. When I started at San Jose State, I was living over the mountains in Santa Cruz. My mother drove me for the first department meetings, helped me make my bookstore rounds, gave me my first mobility lessons downtown and on campus, got me to where I knew my own bus schedule. And only then, I mean, you can say that was me being a little girl, but what it really was great teamwork between mom and me, because after those first 2 weeks, I was doing my own commuting, taking two buses to get to work and two buses back, and it was kind of a long commute each way. And then the process of finding colleagues to ride with. And, you know, the usual thing, you get in a carpool and everything's going fine until the day your driver can't take you because he's sick, and then you're scrambling last minute to get there. But those are sort of normal parts of the process. And although they don't have a lot to do with teaching, I feel that they're worth discussing here because they're certainly a part of the logistics of how we get our work done. I'd like to say one last thing about collaboration, creativity, before I kind of open things up. At West Valley Community College, as the years went by, we were becoming more and more technological, no surprise there. We started teaching online a lot. I actually taught online for 2 years myself. And it seemed like just about every time all of us, not just those of us with vision impairments, there were only two of us on my campus, but just about the time the campus would get comfortable with the college's software grading or progress report filing for students or, you know, early alert, we change the whole system, right? You've got something called Paris, and everybody knows how to use it, and then they go, no, we're switching to this one. And every time that happened, you know, it was a major deal. You know how that is, you know, your software and, you know, hiccups, so on. Well, there was one year where we had these really funky forms that you had to fill in boxes, but the boxes were odd, and you could think you were typing in the box, but you weren't. And site colleagues were having trouble, too, but I had a very dear friend at that point, a fellow professor, and we worked out a deal where she filled in my boxes for her, and I would help her by helping her in the writing lab or tutoring some of her students. In other words, we worked on a trade, and I would trade one of my skills for one of her skills, and that's how we got our jobs done. And that's something that, of course, we do once we're part of an institution and we're making friends and we can do that. Much of it can depend upon the climate of the institution. And, you know, Suzanne, I know you've had different experiences with some climates that are friendlier than others. I think that's all I would like to say for the moment. And now I must apologize for rambling, perhaps. Are you prompted to say anything else based on that, or Suzanne, or should we open this to discussion?
I guess I was just going to say a little bit about this changing world, that I expect that if there were students thinking about coming into teaching at a university level now, this whole online thing is really, really a big change, and some people are getting jobs that's all they do. That's something that wouldn't interest me whatsoever, not just because I'm blind, but because I'm not very technically oriented. I like people. I like being with people. I like talking. So I don't know how much that's going to change the field. In some ways, there are blind people that may do very well with that, and that may be some positive changes for some. But for me, it feels very, very negative, and that's just sort of a frank statement. I guess, you know, I came very close to not getting tenure, and although no one ever said why it was, I believe it's because I was blind, and that's because no one would say anything about it, and I had to fight it with a lot of help from people that did believe that I was in the right place and should have gotten tenure very easily, but I did get it in the end, and that can be a challenge, too. Sometimes when you win something, it's you have to stay with the people that didn't vote you in, and that's a little bit tricky. But at the same time, I did get tenure, so, you know, it's sort of like a... There's a lot of prejudice out there, and it shows up in very strange little ways. Like one colleague, after 16 years, still says, "I get so scared when you're near the stairs." You know, well, at least she admits it now. You know.
Yeah.
But you know, we just have to keep our heads up, keep positive, keep reinforcing the positive, and, you know, just do your best. And that's one good thing about tenure, is that you do kind of have more security. On the other hand, it makes it harder to change and maybe take a new opportunity. So the four-year schools or the tenure positions are secure in a way, but they're also, somebody called it, the golden handcuffs. So,
that's great.
You know, whereas some people don't have tenure at all in the university system, and a lot of administration would like to go further that way, which I think would be negative for freedom of academic issues and things like that, but that's a whole nother kettle of fish. But it might in some ways make it less secure, but it also might lead people to new opportunities if things don't go so well at a certain place. But
my tenuring experience was very smooth, but again, it has to do a little bit with how our community colleges work. When you're hired into a teaching faculty, and remember, I know, Suzanne, you've indicated your university is very student-focused, even more than research-focused. But I had every new hire is given 3 faculty members on the tenure team, and the new hire is evaluated 6 times a semester with 6 classroom visits for the first 2 years, and then 3 times a semester for the latter 2. Each semester, as a teacher, you write up sort of your own goals for your goals collegially, your goals in the classroom, the areas of your teaching practice on which you want to work, and you're mentored by those people on your tenuring team. And I was extremely fortunate because in my college, the attitude was you did a lot of your proving through the interview process. Now we're going to do everything we can to keep you here by nurturing your teaching. And so it was actually a delightful experience, and I trusted my team enough that I did something that was harder for me. I learned to ask them for help, and that was a really exciting thing to actually have the tenure process be we're watching you in the classroom, these are your plans. Every semester we look at the plans and we compare them. We compare the written evaluations, the student evaluations. I actually enjoyed it, and I was even department chair for 2 years. I was chair of our English department. That was harder, and I'll talk about that only if you want me to. There were just some specific challenges that were tough because they had to do with budgets and things like that. But anyway, it kind of depends where you are. I think what your tenuring process can be like. I will say that community college students lately, as of 2013, have also started doing things like using their cell phones in class and walking out in the middle of class and coming in, and they do it to everyone, but they can be very blatant about how they do it with us, and that is something that one does have to deal with.
Yeah, I had one student come and said there was a guy that came into class with his pillow every day.
Oh, gosh.
And just would sleep, and I said, yeah, that does sort of hurt my feelings, but I who's losing here? Not me.
That's right. Yeah.
So
why don't we open it up?
Let's see what people would like to talk about. Comments or questions, or turn it in a totally different direction if you like.
Well, first off, thank you both of you. Hearing of your experiences, hearing of how you've done and achieved what you have is really wonderful for me. My experience has been that I was visually impaired without my college really knowing this. I was hired in this way. I didn't really ask for accommodations, and now I've had a vision loss that has really kind of thrown me into a slightly different territory and yet not absolutely new to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm interested in hearing about some of the ways in which you deliver the content of your classes, and I'm most interested in some of those approaches that you've had, probably take for granted over the years, but that might be of interest.
Yeah, I can certainly start, and I think Susan already mentioned some of her brailing files and things like that. I have developed a system I use, and speaking about technology, I use email and course alias lists pretty liberally. So what, instead of writing on the board, on the smart board, or the whiteboard, they call them now,
yes,
I would make up an outline or whatever and send it to them through this course alias ahead of the course, ahead of the class period, and tell them you can print this out or put it in your computer or whatever you want to do with it. this is what we're going to be talking about for this chapter, and so that sort of thing. In some courses, I put up a Word document on the computer and will type just as if I was going to write on the blackboard or the whiteboard. Type Russian. That happens in my Russian classes. I need to put terms that they need when I'm speaking, because sometimes I don't do them in the same order. So I'll use a Word, just a blank Word document. Don't save it or anything. I also made them ahead of time and pulled them up, but because I'm doing it on the fly, I'd rather write things as I go, just like somebody would on the board. So I figured out that use that sometimes. I use pictures on PowerPoint and maps on PowerPoint, and I had to have sighted help to get those. No doubt about it. There's no way I could judge whether a picture was going to look like something useful or not. Mm-hmm. And so my department did actually give me summer money to have a student help me do that. So we said, okay, we want to do a picture for Columbus and the ships, or you know, whatever, for world history kind of thing. And we got some maps and things that we could put into PowerPoints and show the class. But those are some of the really specific ways that I would deliver content, I guess, is that specifically to being blind and trying to copy what a sighted person would do, and in some ways to give sighted students material that in a format that works for me. So
I guess mine is my process is somewhat similar. Especially in the later years of my teaching, I would prepare my documents on the computer with JAWS and Microsoft Word, and I had pretty good control over the formatting. When I had a student assistant, I would often have that person look over the document and make sure it looked the way I thought it did, help make the photocopies. And that way I could deliver, if I did need to deliver handouts to students, I could do so. I also came to use email to put things up in the course portal when we had an online portal, or I created a group email list for the class, and I said, okay, this week's discussion questions are coming to you through the email, and it was their responsibility then to print them out, because we were all trying to go green a little bit with that. I also find it really helpful to let students help in the classroom. It's empowering for them. Yeah. And if I come in and I say, Maria, we're going to begin today's discussion of this Louise Erdrich story with these questions, and I give her the handout. I said, would you write these on the board for me? So she's scribing up on the blackboard with the one handout, and then we can do that. And then when we were working from a blackboard or doing that kind of brainstorming, different students would come up and be the scribes. And as people in class would call out ideas or whatever, that person would help write them up there. Sometimes, and I would always write myself using whatever Braille device I had brought to class with me, whether it was, a Polaris or a U2 or in the early days of VersaBraille. And I would just, you know, write along with them, and I would often read back, you know, what we had done. And I think it's very important letting students be a part of that reading, writing process and gathering process and giving you feedback on, you know, how does this look? Can you see this? Is everyone able to do this? Can help a great deal. Even a mechanism as simple as you're handing out an exam and you've got 30 people in a room, so you take 15 papers and give them to a student on the left and 15 papers and give them to the student on the right, and that way they get around the room more quickly, you know, than just, I mean, there are a lot of ways to make those physical processes work better. Angela, because you are a composition teacher, I'll share a story from ancient history. When I began my work in 1983, we, of course, had no word processors available, and my students would write compositions and give them to me, and I would have my reader read them, and I would laboriously type out my responses in letter format to students and give them back and, you know, attach them to the papers. And my part-time position was three courses a semester, so that was a pretty heavy part-time load, and for a newbie. And I, after I was there about 6 weeks, was telling a colleague how difficult that was, and she said, why don't you ask your students to, yes, it's ancient history, tape record their essays, record them on cassette, read them aloud, they must paginate, they must say page 1, 2, 3, they must punctuate. You also give a hard copy of their essay to a reader, and that reader works with you, but you record conference comments back on those tapes. You know, that pedagogically worked really well because students were getting personal time with the teacher every time they had a tape, and they could come in and talk about it, but it was still slow. And the contrast with that, and I'm talking to you about this because you mentioned comp, and when you're a comp teacher, you might be, you know, having four classes of 30 and grading, you know, 120 essays every few weeks. You've got to find ways to speed that up. Well, there's no way to speed it up, but by the end of my teaching career, I would have my HIMSS product, U2, in the office. A student would bring me a work in progress on a thumb drive. He would pull it up on the screen, I would pull it up on the Braille display, and we would do our editing together. And it made conference time and office hours go really, really well. You know, and again, using the students' power and having them read to you and having them think aloud and write while you're with them, that's a really good way, I think, to empower them at the same time that you're getting your work done. Have we addressed what you asked?
Oh, absolutely. I'm so excited by these things that you're speaking about. And I noticed just last semester when working on certain things, because some students are much more comfortable handwriting essays at first, mm-hmm. or brainstorming or doing various things, and I would have them read their work aloud to me. And
yes.
I've always been a big believer in that, but I did that so much last semester for obvious reasons, and I found that the process was quite beneficial to them as writers, just because they could hear it.
Yes.
I could hear it. I could make the same sorts of comments. It was just really wonderful. So when you did the tape recorder, you would have them listen to your responses, your comments, after, so that they could actually hear the comments on your paper, on the paper, as end comments, or
well, I would, you know, I did what we always do with essays. You know, I would begin by talking about the strengths of the essay, and
oh, yeah.
I might, you know, I'd
yeah.
talk about paragraphing, and then I would begin talking
but
about.
But you're asking on the tape itself after the essay, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's where I did it. So they had their essay plus my comment right after it, and I always withheld the grade till the end of the comment.
Of course.
Because they had to listen to my Gabby voice to get to the grade.
Well, they could fast forward, yeah. My dear.
Yes, but they did it anyway. I mean, at least I made it harder.
Yeah.
Now,
but this leads to another point that I had not thought of, and this is because we are all blind, doesn't mean we all know Braille, doesn't mean we're all comfortable with different,
right.
You know, certain things.
Right.
So I am totally blind for all intents and purposes. I still have some light, but in terms of actually mobility and reading and all that, it's all sound and it's all guide dog or cane or person. And but I don't use Braille very well. I use it to some degree. But say, I don't have a note taker, Braille versus Braille, that kind of thing, because my Braille has always been very basic. And so that's a difference that I hear. And sort of for the writing, it might really be a beneficial thing. So again, to encourage anybody with vision loss to try and pick up some Braille, even if you don't use it to the degree Susan does, is probably a useful thing. I have a system for calling roll that I actually learned in part from Carla Hayes, who's on AABT, and her book. She has a book on classroom ideas, and she has a lot of things in there, very, very practical ideas for teaching in a K through 12 setting more than college, but they still apply. So I have a Braille list of my students, and I give them each a number, and so I can jot numbers in pen, because I did have vision to read and write when I was younger, on a sticky note, and then I have my assistant go and check those numbers, and we see who is absent and who is present, and, you know, keep track of that sort of thing. So there's some really neat kind of nifty techniques out there for, and probably things that people can figure out. I had an assistant who figured out how to return Scantron tests without showing the other students the grades, once the assistant had given them out on the later days, we put a notebook with those little plastic sleeves in it.
Yeah.
And she put tapes over the grade area so that other students couldn't see the grades for the students. You know, when they flip through to get theirs, they'd pull theirs out of the sleeve, and they'd have their grade, but they wouldn't see anyone else's. So there's a lot of, you know, just, again, just being creative and thinking, and therefore I could take the notebook to class and say, hey, come up and get your test out of the notebook, you know, if you haven't picked it up yet. So
that's cool. That's really cool.
I
like
there's
that.
There's a lot of neat ideas that can come out of just really thinking of, okay, I got to do this, and then sort of brainstorming with either an assistant or your friends or your family and just kind of come up with neat things. And I do recommend Carla's book just for a, you know, place to.
What's it called and where can we get it? Because I've been trying.
I was wondering.
We're going to have to ask Carla because I got it on a cassette, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I bought it somewhere, Carla's, but I don't know where.
Is it Carla with a K or with a C?
With a C.
With a C. Carla's
go ahead,
book
Don.
Is called. I'm sorry. Carla's book is called Teacher's Aid, and it's available through her company, LanguaLearn. But I don't. What I would say is I don't know if it's available in any format that's current nowadays. We would need to check. I've purchased it for clients over the years because she is on New York State contract. So certainly, you know, rehab people may be able to make that kind of purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is quite good. It's a little outdated, I would say, now, but that doesn't mean that the general ideas aren't useful. And
exactly.
Some of the things are useful anyway. It's just that there's things that would be in there now that aren't in there. I just wanted to make one other comment. When you were talking about the interview process, I want to make sure that nobody, particularly people hearing the recording, get the wrong idea. An employer can ask questions about how a job would be performed by a person with a vision impairment, but the questions have to relate specifically to the job duties. So if someone says, for example, when I was interviewing, trying to get work at teaching English in the middle school, it was fine for them to say, how are you going to manage your classroom? Now, with that said, many colleges and universities and federal jobs have a very set standard list of questions that they're using with everyone, and their policy is not to deviate from the list. So that may cause them not to deviate. The other thing is that even though employers are allowed to ask those questions, a lot of them are afraid to because they're afraid of litigation. So what happens is that employers have questions running through their minds that they don't ask. And one of the things I spend a lot of time talking about with my clients who are looking for work is, what does the blindness mean to you? When are you comfortable bringing it up? Let's talk about some strategies. And what I very often will have them do is, I want you to make a list of the questions that you think might be running through the employer's mind. Because what that does is it takes them kind of out of themselves and into the idea of, like I always say, if you go into an interview and you talk about Jaws, they're going to hear that music running through their mind, and they're going to picture sharks. They're not going to know what you're talking about. So there's that kind of planning that goes into it.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point, and you are correct. I've been on search committees. I've been on the other end now, and the university definitely has a policy that you have to ask the same questions, absolutely, of every candidate. So whether the law allows it or not, they're not going to deviate. So it is really incumbent on the interviewee to really sort of set them at ease and share things and say, I'd like to point out to you how, you know, yes, I'm blind, but this isn't going to affect my ability to do the job, and here's how I do things, and I welcome your questions, you know, just put them at ease. And whether they ask or not, they know that you've put them at ease, and that's how you would teach a course too, I would think. Because I do that with my students every semester. I said, do you have any questions? Don't be shy, because I want you to learn what you want to know, you know, and then you'll move on, and I'll just be another one of your professors.
One of the things I always say on the first day is if you raise your hand, your arm is going to get really tired.
Yeah,
it's going to just be up there for 16 weeks. So let's learn each other's names and let's use them. And we do.
Yes. And no nodding.
No, please.
You know,
I tell them they get a good skill in my class. They get to learn how to be proactive.
Exactly.
Well,
you know, I recently had an experience. With PowerPoint, I've been having, they switched my classroom and then they put JAWS on it, but I hadn't been able to get the PowerPoint to work. So I had my students use, we had made PowerPoint handouts when I taught the course when I was doing my doctorate. And so there's the PDFs with, you know, a couple slides per page. And so I just had them use their devices, because everybody has their devices with them, and they were able to pull up their PDFs, and I asked them, I said, you know, next time I can get the PowerPoints on the computer, hopefully, but I said, was it difficult for you to use this? And they actually said they liked it because they preferred having control of how quickly they advanced to the next material and being able to do that. So it was kind of like Wi-Fi City Hall. Let them use their smart devices, but make them use them for the purpose
of the course.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully it works that way, but I use Braille to lecture from, and they said, well, you know, that they kind of, I think, found that interesting. And
sure. Thomas, let me just clarify. You sent them the PowerPoints on some sort of an email so that they could pull them up on their phones?
We had put them on Canvas on our online course system.
Oh,
and
so
I
they would go to the site and
up.
Pick it up. Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and this is a struggle for me because the university hadn't gotten my hiring paperwork done, and so I didn't have access to my course as the official instructor until it was the semester technically started. It was before my first class, but so a colleague was able to be the instructor and put stuff up for me. But now I have all the official paperwork, but I'm trying to learn to use this system and playing catch up.
Canvas is new at my college as well.
And
they just changed the system. Is Canvas new?
We've had it, but the thing is, when I was doing my doctorate, I used it as a student, and when I taught, I was a co-instructor, so my colleague did more of the techie stuff. I would prepare materials and send them to her, and she would, you know, check them for formatting and fix any spacing in the PowerPoints and then put stuff in Canvas. So I didn't learn as much as I might have done at that point about the technology of that particular type of technology.
Right.
And this is a frustration because every university has different things. We have something called desire to learn, which I call desire to loaf, but.
Oh my. Yeah.
That's funny. Do you all use Banner Admin?
Oh, gosh.
Uh-oh. Okay, I take it that's a yes, because we have it, and parts of it are accessible and parts are not. I can't even get into Banner Admin. I can get into Banner, but not at the admin part.
No,
so
when
you have to perform
access.
A task that requires you to get into the part that you can't, do you talk to a colleague? How do you do it? How do you solve it?
Well, that's in the Office of Accessibility part, where I have to enter accommodations. And so, yes, I have to email what I need entered to my boss, and she enters it for me.
Okay.
And I need to figure out whether the submitting grades and stuff portion is accessible. In our faculty, you know, tools, I'm going to have to go in and play with that. Otherwise, I'll probably end up having to, ask one of my,
This is the kind of thing, and maybe I'm a little bit old-fashioned, and maybe because I do use Russian, and Russian is not easy to read in any other format than with a person, I do think it's perfectly legitimate to ask for at least some hour's worth of sighted assistance.
Even in
a job. And I think that's perfectly reasonable, perfectly rational, and this is the kind of thing where this would really help. Because these things change constantly, and if you're trying to keep up with it and trying to learn it, the IT people don't know how to teach you to do it differently. You know, they don't understand how JAWS does or doesn't work or what does or doesn't work. They say, click your mouse, you know.
Yeah.
Like, sorry, I don't use the mouse. What? You know? So this is something that I just feel very strongly about, that independence and efficiency have to be balanced.
I couldn't agree more. And there are definitely times when that pair of eyes, and it's also can be very useful. I can't tell you how many students were my sighted assistants, and I interviewed them, I trained them, and it was a work experience for them, a work experience for me. Everybody gained, I think, in the end.
Yeah.
And some experiences worked out better than others. Some were awful, some were wonderful. But a student assistant went on to become a professor himself at our sister campus later, which was really fun, you know. But so it's all part of the landscape. I need to interject here. It's 5:59. I personally will need to leave at about 8:59. You know why? I'm out here in California. You know,
she's on the West Coast.
I only say that because you set it up on the recording as it was 8 o'clock. That's
I know, and they're going to think we went, you know, backwards through time, some weird loop or something. Which if I were in control, could happen anyway. So I am going to ask everyone's permission to stop the recording. And then when I have to go, if you want to continue the workshop, it's fine. You won't be cut off. The problem, if I don't save the recording and leave, it won't save, and we want to make sure it's saved. Is there anything else we want on the recording right now? We could go another 5 minutes or so if people wanted for that.
Did everybody get a question if they had it or comment if they had it?
Yes, and thank you.
Anyone? Alan, Don, anything?
I'm fine. I'm just listening.
Okay. What I'd like to do with the group's permission is stop the recording, and then we can talk until you don't want to talk or whatever. So just give me a second here.